The Isle of Man's constitution was last debated by Tynwald on the 22nd of November 2000. So Tynwald's Constitutional and Legal Affairs and Justice Committee has decided that the time is right to re-examine the issue. Back in 2000, Donald Gelling was Chief Minister, and he moved that the Council of Ministers report on the implications of independence be received and the recommendation contained therein be approved. In the opening debate, he said, "The report before honourable members today represents the fourth in a sequence analysing constitutional objects for the Isle of Man. In the second such report, it was recommended that all opportunities for extending the island's autonomy within the broad framework of its existing relationship with the United Kingdom should be taken so as to maximise the island's self-government and self-determination." Mr. Gelling continued, "More recently, sentiment has been expressed in a number of quarters that independence for the Isle of Man would prove to be useful or a useful vehicle through which to defend our interests with regard to a number of the international developments, most particularly those of the EU and the OECD with regard to taxation. Nonetheless, whilst the issue of the island's constitutional position has perhaps been thrown into greater relief very recently because of these developments, the work of the Constitutional and External Relations Committee of the Council of Ministers considering the ways in which the island's economy might be extended predates these recent moves." And this was Donald Gelling speaking in November 2000. He continued, "Now, the committee's researchers have shown that it has proved difficult to identify areas where constitutional progress might be made short of making a move towards independence. We have looked at independence, and this current report examines the main themes which have emerged as a result of these investigations and summarises what the Council of Ministers perceive as the likely advantages and disadvantages of independence. Members will perhaps not need reminding that in recent times significant steps have been taken towards greater autonomy for the Isle of Man. These have included the transfer of powers and responsibilities from the United Kingdom to the Isle of Man government, and similarly the transfer of powers and responsibilities from the Lieutenant Governor to locally elected representatives. The Isle of Man government's stated policy with regards to constitutional development, as set out in successive policy documents, is in itself informed by a Tynwald resolution dating from 1981. The shared objective of both Tynwald and government is that the Isle of Man's constitutional relationship with the United Kingdom should continue to evolve towards more complete self-government. The constitutional developments of modern times have therefore been consistent with this aspiration. Nonetheless, these developments have in turn brought difficulty with them. The island has secured a level of autonomy where there is frankly little scope for further significant advancement short of, as I have already stated, full independence. Where there are areas in which advancement may be possible, opportunities are pursued." That was then Chief Minister Donald Gelling speaking in the debate in Tynwald on Wednesday the 22nd of November 2000. While there were some modest gains made in the early 2000s following that debate, little or no work has been done to reform our constitutional relationship with the UK over the past few decades. So, is that about to change? On Perspective this week, we hear the evidence given by long-serving Jersey politician Sir Philip Balazs KC to Tynwald's Constitutional and Legal Affairs and Justice Committee. And I should apologise in advance for the quality of this recording.
"I'm Tanya August Hansen, MLC. I'm the chair of this committee. With me are also David Ashford, MBE, MHK. Mr. Stu Peters was unable to join us this morning. This meeting forms part of our inquiry into the constitution of the Isle of Man, and we're welcoming a parliamentarian from Jersey, Sir Philip Balazs KC. A very welcome to you and to this evidence session. Can you just give us a brief summary of your career in the States of Jersey?"
Yes, certainly. My political life started in 1972 when I was elected as a deputy, but I then was appointed in 1975 as the island's Solicitor General, and Attorney General in 1986, and then I became bailiff in 1995 and held that office until 2009. I then continued to be a part-time judge for a couple of years, and in 2011 I decided to stand again for political office, and I was elected as a senator and became the assistant chief minister to Ian Gorst. And I'm very sorry that he's not here this morning, because he has other pressures on him, his time at the moment, as he's standing for the post of chief minister tomorrow. And then I became the first minister for external relations in 2013 and held that role until 2018, when I retired from the States. In 2022, I rashly perhaps decided to stand again for election, and I was elected this time as a deputy, and I'm now a backbencher with various roles in the States. So that's my history.
And you've had some, it'd be interesting to hear, have you an opening statement, because there have been some comments, I think, in the past about constitutional reform that you've had to make. Perhaps you might give us an overview of that and your opinions there.
Yes, I chaired a working group called the Constitution Review Group in 2006 through to 2008, which was charged with the responsibility of investigating whether or not independence was an option for Jersey. And we, with the Policy and Resources Committee at the time, worked to some terms of reference, which were essentially to see whether or not the island was capable of coping with independence in the event that external forces made that a necessary consideration. So we did quite a lot of work on various aspects of our constitutional relationship. We considered defence and internal security. We considered international relations, internal constitutional considerations, economic considerations, of course, and then an et cetera bunch of considerations such as wireless telegraphy and the common travel area and various other issues. And we made a number of recommendations to the Policy and Resources Committee. And that report was published by the States in 2008. So it was a very interesting exercise. I think, in a nutshell, it concluded that the island was capable of dealing with independence should the necessity arise.
And what was the response, the general response from parliamentarians to that information, following all of the research and the evidence that was gathered and presented to them?
Well, I think one of the consequences of the report and the recommendations made in the report was that a number of changes were made to our internal arrangements. In particular, the Chief Minister's Department decided to increase its capacity for dealing with external relations. Until that time, there had been just one part-time official dealing with these issues, and that was then enhanced. And as I was saying earlier on, in 2013, we decided to create an Office of Minister of External Relations, which is now a small department with about 15 people working for it. And we found that quite a useful change.
And that was the first occupant of that position was Ian Gorst, was it not? What were those conversations at the time about how it was formed? Did it, and that the principles around actually bringing that together, do you think that that's bared fruit now, and can you see sort of the aims and the intentions, the outcomes from back then, and how that's kind of played out?
The consequences of the board were, I think, beneficial. So far as the reaction of the members of the states was concerned, I think they were interested and they clearly supported the creation of the Ministry of External Relations.
Do you think that the outcomes, when the first conversations started about having an external relations ministry, do you think that the principle around that and the outcomes that were expected, do you think that that's bared fruit now, that it's been running for as long as it has?
I think one of the consequences, I'm not sure whether it's the creation of the Ministry of External Relations or whether it's the establishment of the London office, but I think we've certainly found it much easier to relate to the United Kingdom government. And because we have an office in London, it's easy for officials there to go round to the Ministry of Justice and build up closer relationships, I think, than could happen if we were operating only from Jersey. So far as the external element of it is concerned, it proved its worth rather early on, because in 2013, by reason really of a misunderstanding, I think, the French placed us on a blacklist, this was quite a serious matter, and resulted in the External Relations Ministry having very urgent discussions with the French in Paris. And ultimately I went and spoke to the relevant ministers there, and we persuaded the French to take us off the blacklist, which I think few people had expected was going to happen. So it was an early success, I think, for the Ministry of External Relations.
You're listening to Perspective and long-serving Jersey politician Sir Philip Balazs KC, giving evidence to Tynwald's Constitutional and Legal Affairs and Justice Committee. You're listening to Sir Philip Balazs, who gave evidence to Tynwald's Constitutional, Legal Affairs and Justice Committee. The committee is investigating the pros and cons of independence for the Isle of Man. Apologies again for the quality of this recording, but I hope you agree it's well worth listening to.
In terms of the External Relations Ministry, it was quite an innovative thing for the Crown dependencies, because most ministerial officers tend to be inward-looking, whereas External Relations, by its very nature, is outward-looking. So you mentioned there about, obviously, the situation with the French in 2013. What do you think has been the big advantage of having the External Relations Ministry that Jersey wouldn't have had if it hadn't been there?
I think we've been enabled to build up a number of quite good relationships with the different embassies and high commissions that exist in London. The minister, certainly when I was minister, and I'm sure the practice has continued, goes to see ambassadors and high commissioners of countries with which we have an interest commercially. For example, I remember going to see the high commissioner of India, because we were wanting to build up closer relationships and perhaps even have a bilateral investment treaty with India. Now, I don't think anything came of that, or it hasn't come of it yet. But the ability to go and talk to have somebody with specific responsibility for foreign affairs, I think helped us to open doors in London at embassies and high commissions, and that was helpful. And we also used to have an annual dinner at which we invited the ambassadors of countries which were of interest to us, mainly European countries, but some others as well. And that was an event which was also, I think, quite successful. And so I think it's been a very positive exercise over the last 10 years.
In terms of the UK, do you think it's opened more doors at Westminster in terms of MPs at Westminster understanding the Crown dependencies, understanding what Jersey's about? Because that's always been a bit of a difficulty, I think, for the Crown dependencies to actually get not so much the government and the ministries, but ordinary parliamentarians to understand what the Crown dependencies are.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it is difficult, particularly with backbenchers, and one's seen recently some backbenchers taking actions against the Crown dependencies, which have not been particularly welcome. And I think a presence in London is quite helpful in that respect. I mean, I don't know how many exactly there are, but there are more than 600 members of Parliament, so it's not possible to go and meet them all, but certainly key members one can target. And some of them are not willing to engage, but most of them are, and one can have some quite useful conversations.
In terms of the themes of our inquiry are around the sort of the events of the last 25 years or so, and whether they've had any effect on our constitution. Do you think that the way that people look at the Crown dependencies has changed as a result of things like the Scottish and Welsh devolution in the UK?
I think it probably has changed. I think there is still a conviction amongst certain members of Parliament in Westminster that ultimately the UK rules the Crown dependencies, and it's difficult to overcome that. But I think the existence of a Scottish Parliament and Welsh Assembly has helped, and it's opened eyes of members of Parliament to the fact that there are constitutional relationships which are different. I mean, we think in Jersey that the Crown dependencies have much greater autonomy actually than the devolved territories, the devolved countries. That I think is a message that we need to get across. As you know, the arrangements with Scotland are all embodied in a Scotland Act, and our constitutional relationship is rather more fluid and not quite so easy to understand. So it is important to try to make MPs understand the broad autonomy that we do have in domestic affairs.
Do you think that That particularly relationships between government departments, say for example, and the MOJ, so DEFRA, and Department of something similar to the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture over here on the Isle of Man, do you think that those relationships are somewhat strained, perhaps by misunderstandings about the Crown dependencies, what they are, what they do, what kind of autonomy that they have? Do you think that there are some misconceptions? Have you experienced that? In trying to move projects forward?
Yes, I think I think it's fair to say that the Ministry of Justice has a fairly good understanding of our constitutional relationship, and I don't think there's any difficulty there. But when it comes to, for example, trying to obtain an entrustment to engage with another foreign country to have a bilateral investment treaty or some engagement which requires an entrustment, it's much more difficult to get other departments of the UK government to understand our constitutional relationship. I mean, we certainly it took years to get an entrustment for us to negotiate with the UAE a bilateral investment treaty, and that was largely because I think other departments were getting in the way.
Do you think that that's been improved by the external relations changes in Jersey?
Up to a point, I think. We certainly in London try to engage with other departments which are relevant to whatever the business to be conducted is. We've never been very successful in engaging with the Foreign Office, which is, in one sense, disappointing, but perhaps a good thing, because I think the Foreign Office would be much less tolerant of us than the Ministry of Justice is, having a kind of preconceived view bred of their relationship with the overseas territories as to what dependent territories should do.
Sticking with the subject of needing to have understanding from UK government departments of the Crown dependencies, who they are, what they do, Brexit and COVID, do you think that constitutional arrangements that were made there, were there difficulties in understanding between government departments and Jersey departments in trying to move things forward?
Yes, I think that the outcome of the Brexit negotiations was quite disappointing from our perspective in Jersey. Anyway, we thought, and I don't know whether the Isle of Man feels the same way, but we thought we had quite a good relationship with the European Union arising out of the Protocol 3, and we didn't really want that to change. And I think we personally, looking back on it, that we made a mistake, and I was party to that mistake, in not pressing the UK a little bit harder to try to maintain Protocol 3 for the benefit of the Crown dependencies. We were told that this was not constitutionally possible and that our relationship with Europe was dependent upon the United Kingdom's relationship, but I don't think actually that legally that was necessarily correct, and I think it might have been possible to find some means of preserving Protocol 3, and that would have been a great advantage. The problems which have occurred since Brexit, to my mind, are that we have become tied up much more closely in the United Kingdom arrangements than we were before. And although we have had the ability through the UK to piggyback on to some of the agreements, free trade agreements that have been made, I don't think that has been personally entirely satisfactory.
Yes, so obviously the two big challenges that everyone always remembers, of course, is Brexit and COVID, but there was also beneficial ownership, which sometimes gets forgotten about now. And of course, one of the unique things about that was it wasn't the UK government trying to legislate for the Crown dependencies, it was actually backbenchers, because in normal circumstances, obviously, you would have a government with a majority, and the Westminster system tends to be set up around that. But when you have a hung parliament, do you think one of the risks at the moment that we face is that it basically a hung parliament, anything goes, so individual backbenchers, if they can get support across the House, could in theory start legislating for the Crown dependencies? It's a bit of a leading question. But I've asked it of our other witnesses as well. Do you think there's merit maybe in exploring the option that when the UK government wants to legislate for the Crown dependencies, that Westminster sets a rule that such bills can only come from the government of the day, rather than you having, say, a rogue backbencher deciding they want to treat the Crown dependencies as if they are devolved territories?
Well, I think that doing things only through the government and not through rogue backbenchers, as you would describe them, would probably be an improvement. But I'm not sure that necessarily protects the Crown dependencies in the way in which one might like to think. We certainly found in 2018 that when backbenchers wanted to bring an amendment to, I forget which act it was, to ensure that the Crown dependencies had public registers of beneficial ownership. We were supported by the government, and we were supported by the government for a very good reason, which was that, and I don't know what the position in the Isle of Man is, but certainly so far as the Channel Islands are concerned, we both have legislation which requires any prospective order in council or prospective act which is going to apply to the Channel Islands to be referred to the States Assembly. And if the States Assembly were to say, no, we don't want this particular statutory provision, there is no possibility that the Royal Court in Jersey would register an order in council or an act. And under our constitutional rules, any orders in council or acts of the UK Parliament have to be registered in the Royal Court before they can come into effect. So the Royal Court would take a hint from the states. And you then have a very unfortunate situation with a Parliament of one country saying one thing, Parliament of another country saying another. There'd be a deadlock. And I think the British government really understood that in 2018 and probably still understand it. And so there would be an advantage in making sure it could only be done through government. But I think our real constitutional protection lies in our own statutes.
I think that you're quite lucky in terms of referrals into the States Assembly. We don't have such a provision here in our standing orders. Can you tell us, from your perspective and your experience, about the process of getting royal assent for Jersey legislation?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that Jersey is paddling a different canoe from both Guernsey and the Isle of Man.
Yeah.
I think there are two reasons for that. The first reason is that although we did go through a very bad stage some years ago, when it used to take an inordinate amount of time for Privy Council sanction to be given to Jersey laws, in recent years the position has greatly improved. And I was looking before this meeting at our website to see what the position was, and it seems that it takes about 8 to 10 weeks for Privy Council sanction to be given to a Jersey law. I mean, that's not perhaps ideal, but it's not too bad. But the second reason for not wanting to go the way of Guernsey and the Isle of Man is that we have a perhaps a slightly different relationship with our Lieutenant Governor. Our Lieutenant Governor we regard as an entirely independent operator. He is His Majesty's personal representative in Jersey, and his duty, we think, and certainly we tell our Lieutenant Governors this when they arrive, his duty is to the King and to the King's subjects in Jersey. And he has no duty to the United Kingdom government. He has no duty to the Jersey government. His duty is to the people of Jersey. And having that kind of independence, we think, is quite important, because occasionally the governor can act as an intermediary in solving difficulties, which we found in the past to be quite useful. The difficulty with having a governor giving royal assent is that sooner or later the governor is going to find himself obliged to refuse consent to a bill. And that, I think, would cause in Jersey great difficulties in terms of the relationship between the states and the governor. And we want to avoid that. So that's the second reason why we, at the moment anyway, choose not to follow Guernsey and the Isle of Man.
Right, thank you. Does your system work well, in your opinion? Are there any modifications that perhaps might benefit it?
I personally think there is a modification which could make things better. And I would like to see royal assent being dealt with in much the same way as it's dealt with in Scotland under the Scotland Act. And as you no doubt know, in Scotland, the royal assent is given automatically after a certain period of time. I forget exactly what it is, a month or 6 weeks or whatever. And royal assent follows unless the Secretary of State enters a dissent of some kind and refers the matter to the courts as not being in accordance with the devolution provisions in the Scotland Act. It's hardly ever happened. In fact, it only happened, I think, once and quite recently in relation to controversial legislation in Scotland. And I think that's perhaps a rather better way of dealing with royal assent, and I'm certainly we are exploring that in Jersey to see whether that is a possibility.
I think Mr. Ashford would like to come in now. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the big things, of course, that certainly I've seen change in my time in politics is the way the Crown dependencies work together. During your time, do you feel the Crown dependencies are more united and working together now than they have been previously? And what advantage do you think it brings when the Crown dependencies do work as a unit?
Well, I'm not a member of government at the moment, and so I'm not competent to answer the question in terms of the current relationship, but from the outside, it seems to be working quite well. We have different interests sometimes. We are competitors commercially, and occasionally the islands will want to go in different directions. But broadly speaking, I think you are absolutely right. I think we are far, far stronger, certainly constitutionally, when we work together. And a very good example of that, actually, has been the recent joint statement that was made in relation to registers of beneficial ownership. I thought that was an extremely persuasive paper and explained the position of the Crown dependencies extremely well. And I nurture the hope, maybe may not turn out to be that way, but I nurture the hope that it might even persuade some backbenchers in the UK that they've got it wrong.
I think that on many an occasion I've talked to parliamentarians both in Jersey and in Guernsey, and the general consensus seems to be that we work stronger, that we work better and stronger when we're together on certain matters. Obviously it can't be on everything, but on certain matters, particularly like domestic matters and any threats to our domestic our position and our autonomy, it seems to be that's the general thought process with Parliament, a lot of the parliamentarians that I've talked to.
I would absolutely agree.
You talked about the independence of the Lieutenant Governor. Do you know anything about that independence and what that looks like on Jersey's statute?
I don't think there's anything in statute about it, actually. I think it's we regard it as our sort of customary law approach to the position of the Lieutenant Governor. I mean, the position of the Lieutenant Governor has changed over the years. Mm. He used to be able to convene the States Assembly, and he used to be able to veto resolutions of the states. But his position has become much different in the last 25 years. And we think his independent position is an advantage that we don't really want to lose.
Yeah, I think we've sort of felt much the same way, but there's been an awful lot sort of littered throughout our statute book about what the Lieutenant Governor could and couldn't do before, things that have sort of lingered on the statute book, things that he can do now, perhaps, and other things that you know, that are on statute that have just, he's changed practices of, but are still sort of sat there across our statute book that need altering and changing. And we have a report, which is a 2011 report, 2011 report on the functions of the Lieutenant Governor, that was on our Tim Wall decisions, policy decisions list for government to get on with, but was removed in the last administration, and we're now looking at recommendation to put it back on the list of things that they may need to do. So I just wondered if there was anything that perhaps might be lingering on the Jersey statute book about the Lieutenant Governor that perhaps hasn't necessarily been looked at, but has changed and altered over time in terms of what he is and isn't doing.
Well, there certainly have been changes. As I said, he used to have a right of veto, which was repealed in the 2005 State of Jersey law. He still has a right to speak in the Assembly, but the convention is that he only speaks twice, once when he arrives, and once just before he leaves. And I think we would find it pretty uncomfortable if the Lieutenant Governor were to take it upon himself suddenly to take part in a debate. I think that might very well lead to some kind of statutory intervention to make sure that he didn't do that. But so far, the Governor has respected the convention.
Can you tell us about the process for when the UK wants to legislate for Jersey, and any history recent or you know, far gone history that you might come to mind?
I think we've taken the view for quite a long time now that the United Kingdom Parliament does not have the right to legislate for Jersey without the consent of the states, and our policy is, generally speaking, to try to have domestic legislation dealing with any issues that have to be dealt with, rather than extending United Kingdom acts. It's true that, I mean, we do still have a number of UK statutes which are extended, the Immigration Act, for example, the British Nationality Act, and others. But the general policy is to try to have domestic legislation whenever we can. We changed, for example, we were told, I remember when I was Attorney General, that we were told that it was not possible to have a local extradition law. But that changed about 10 years ago. And we enacted an extradition law, which works quite well, it's quite possible to deal with extradition, notwithstanding the fact that there is a specialist court in the UK that deals with those things.
And speaking of immigration and the Legal Migration Act, when we talked to Deputy Sam Mezek and also Guernsey's Gavin St Pierre, we discussed what Parliament, but also, you know, what indications from governments there might be in relation to that particular piece of legislation, and how both have responded to that piece of legislation from the UK.
Well, interestingly, I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that question, because I asked the relevant minister a question in the States not long ago, did not receive a very satisfactory answer. I think it was said that it was still being worked on by the Law Officers Department, and nobody really seemed to know what the draft order in council, which ultimately may be put before the states, was going to say. Some parts of the Unlawful Migration Act do need to be extended, I think, because they deal with changes to the Immigration Act and changes to the British Nationality Act, which we would I think, want to have enacted in Jersey. Other parts are more controversial, and I'm not sure that we would want to have them enacted, but I'm not sure that it's necessary for them to be enacted. I think the United Kingdom is much more concerned with people crossing the Channel and coming in small boats to the Straits of Dover than they are about immigrants coming to the Channel Islands. I mean, we have an informal arrangement with the French that if an unlawful immigrant comes ashore in Jersey, he can be immediately repatriated to France, and the French will take him back because he came from France, obviously. So we don't think that there is a problem in the same way as there is currently a problem with unlawful immigration into the UK. So I think we probably would resist any kind of extension of those kind of provisions. I certainly don't think we want to get involved in controversial issues like sending immigrants out to Rwanda.
Not so long ago when we did have that conversation with Deputy Mezek and Deputy Gareth St-Pierre, we had a similar response that it's not really a problem for the Channel Islands, and that it hasn't reared its head recently. There doesn't seem to be much interest from immigrants to want to take that route into the UK. But only a week ago, there were three illegal immigrants that were helped into Guernsey, which is obviously just on your doorstep. So do you think that perhaps there could be stronger measures put in place, or would that prompt that, or has that changed the general thought and feeling towards that particular piece of legislation from the UK and how it's then applied to Jersey? Has there been a change in thinking, is what I'm asking, following that?
I'm not familiar with the recent Guernsey events, and I do know that the last time it happened in Jersey, the immigrant was put on a boat and sent straight back to France. Although there has been an occasion when we did deal with an asylum claim in Jersey, it doesn't seem to me to be a huge problem. I mean, there may be the occasional immigrant who manages to get across, but so far, I'm touching wood at this stage, these great mass of immigrants who are waiting to enter the United Kingdom don't seem to have cottoned on to the fact that they might try the Channel Islands first.
Let's hope they're not listening to this then. the representing the islands in the UK, do you feel that Jersey is well represented? There's been a lot of conversation about Guernsey and Guernsey's the twinning of the two islands and their external relations approach. Do you think that that's useful, helpful?
I think it, on the whole, it sort of seems to be working quite well at the moment. We have a joint office with Guernsey, as you know, in Brussels, and we also have a joint office in Normandy. But the London office is a Jersey office, and I think we would probably resist making that a joint office, because it's much bigger, and I think in terms of relationships between Jersey and Guernsey and the United Kingdom, it's probably better to keep them structurally separate, even if one does try to work together as much as one can.
The term Crown dependency, Now, on a number of occasions, you'll probably have had this conversation with others that have come through this committee with an interest in the conversation around the term Crown dependency. I think most seem to be very interested in keeping the word Crown, but the word dependency seems to sort of strike a nerve. Does it strike a nerve with you?
It does, yes. I think dependency is quite the wrong term, because for all practical purposes, we are not dependent upon the United Kingdom. I know that the UK is responsible for our defence, but we learnt in 1940 that the Channel Islands are not really defensible. And so far as foreign affairs are concerned, we have aspirations to do rather more in foreign affairs than we do at the moment. And I don't think dependent is the right term. I think the three Crown dependencies, if I may be so bold, should join together and say, look, we don't want to be called dependencies anymore. We ought to be called Crown territories.
So you prefer territories. I think when we talked to Gavin St Pierre, he suggested dominions, and then others suggested that perhaps that might be a bit colonial.
I think dominion might be a bit colonial, and I don't think actually that constitutionally we are a dominion. I think territory is probably better. It's fairly neutral.
David?
Yeah, you mentioned before, Sir Philip, about the London office. And how has that worked in practice? Do you feel it's delivered great benefit for Jersey in terms of the contacts you'd be able to make? And what do you think the London office and having that ability down there has actually delivered that you wouldn't have been able to do had that office not existed?
It's quite difficult to put a finger on this, actually. It's really a sense that I have that... apart from all the engagement with ambassadors and high commissioners that I mentioned earlier on, so far as the UK is concerned, I do think that our relationship with the Ministry of Justice is easier and smoother and more friendly than it was before we had a London office. The head of the London office has a cup of coffee once a month with the head of the unit at the MOJ. And so they build up a relationship. And I think personal relationships are actually quite important. I mean, they're important between the three, let me call it the Crown territories. It's important between Jersey, Guernsey, and the Isle of Man. We ought to try to build up personal relationships at all kinds of different levels as much as we can, because that's the way in which friendships grow and business is done much more easily.
Just on that very topic, if you go back to sort of the 70s, 80s and even early 90s, we tended to be passed around government departments in Whitehall as to where our links were, because it seemed to be the UK government could never quite decide what to do with us. The Ministry of Justice, which is our current link, from my mind, seems to have historically outlasted most other relationships. Do you think the Ministry of Justice is a good fit for us?
I think it's probably as good a fit as any that we would have. I would have reservations about the Foreign and Commonwealth Office because of its relationship with the overseas territories, which is very different constitutionally from our relationship with the UK. The Home Office is now such a huge organisation that I think we would probably be entirely forgotten if we were under the Home Office. And I think probably the Ministry of Justice, which has a responsibility for constitutional affairs in the UK as well, is as good a fit as any. The disadvantage, I suppose, is that it's a small department, and therefore, you know, the Privy Councillor who has responsibility for our relations is not generally such a big hitter as, for example, the Home Secretary would be. But I think on balance, I'm as happy with the Ministry of Justice as I would be anywhere.
That was Jersey politician Sir Philip Balish KC's evidence to the Tynwald Constitutional and Legal Affairs and Justice Committee. The committee is investigating whether greater independence for the Isle of Man would be a good or bad thing. So are you pro-independence, or do you think that we're better off with the relationship we currently have with the United Kingdom? I'm Phil Gorn. Gonna mayo san geisach rum. Thanks for listening.